Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, talk about foster, adoptive, and kinship care. I'm Dawn Davenport, and I am both the host of this show as well as the director of the nonprofit, creatingafamily.org. Today, we're going to be talking about building resilience in our kids. We'll be talking with Dr. Caroline Leaf. She is a communications pathologist, audiologist, clinical and cognitive neuroscientist, and she has a master's and PhD in communication pathology. She is the author of several books, including Switched on Your Brain, Think, Learn, Succeed, and How to Help Your Child Clean Up Their Mental Mess. Welcome, Dr. Leaf, to Creating a Family.
Thank you. Lovely to be with you, Dawn.
So on this show, we talk a lot about trauma, adverse childhood experiences, prenatal exposure to alcohol and drugs, and other things that can alter our kids' brains and make it harder, quite frankly, for them to live healthy and happy lives. However, I so often think it is equally important to focus on our kids' abilities to overcome these challenges, to focus on their resilience and their strength. So I'm looking forward to talking with you specifically about your new book, How to Help Your Child Clean Up Their Mental Mess. And in the book, you talk about the mind-brain-body connection. And it seems like that is really foundational to our understanding everything else. So let's start there. What do you mean by the mind-brain-body connection?
Well, first of all, great podcast and focus that you have. And it's just so important that we do focus on being proactive about helping our children develop the mental skills to be able to cope with life and what they're exposed to. So the mind-brain-body connection, scientifically, we call psychoneurobiology. Psycho with mind, neurobrain, biology, body. A lot of the time we hear people talking about the mind and brain as though it's the same thing. And that's been very common over the last 40 years, where there's been much more focus on the brain, brain, brain in a very neuro-reductionistic way as we've learned more about the brain. I've been in the field for nearly 40 years now, and I've watched this progression. So the mind-brain connection is talking about the fact that the mind and the brain are not the same thing. They're actually separate, which interestingly enough, Dawn, has been the case for thousands of years. For thousands of years, if you look at the philosophical writings and the spiritual writings and research for 150 years, that's been the focus, that the mind, brain, body connection are separate but intimately connected. So the mind we can talk about as being embodied in the brain and the body, but the mind is a driving force.
You're making a distinction between the mind and the brain.
Yes.
Okay, gotcha. Okay.
The mind is not the brain. That's very important. And people can be excused for thinking it is because, as I mentioned, for the past 40 years, that's been very much what the speak has been. The general language has been mind is, oh, my mind, oh, my brain.
They're synonymous in many people's.
Exactly. And that has been the focus in a lot of the literature, a lot of the media, a lot of the psychological speak in the last 40 years. But it's not accurate scientifically. There's a huge body of research, 150 years of good scientific modern research, plus thousands of years, as I mentioned, philosophically of understanding the separation. And the reason I'm emphasizing that is because if we just see ourselves as a mechanical brain, then everything is about the brain and the body. And therefore, we as humans don't kind of have any control. If your brain is broken, well, then what's the point? Mm-hmm. So this manifests in overdiagnosing, overlabeling, and that kind of thing.
Interesting.
So my work has been around understanding the separation and the integration. They're separate, but they're intimately connected because the mind can't work without the brain and the body. I mean, it can, but it works efficiently with the brain and the body. So the mind uses the brain. The brain responds to the mind. The mind uses the body. The body responds to the mind. So the mind is like a driving force. And the easiest way to understand mind is your aliveness. The fact that we can have this conversation, people are listening to us, the ability to process what you're hearing, that's your mind. And then your mind will take this conversation and literally put that into the brain and grow it into the brain and the body in two different types of networks. So that's the mind-brain-body connection. And everything about life, from the moment you wake up till the moment you go to sleep, you are building life into the brain and the body and the mind, but via the mind. The mind is doing the work. The brain and the body are responding. And whatever goes into this tripartite network or this psychoneurobiological network, those become the thoughts that drive how we function. So you talk a lot about adverse child experiences on this podcast, as you mentioned in the beginning. So every experience that a child has, and an adult, obviously, but if a child has an adverse experience, that is building into the mind, brain, and body. If it's not processed, and if it's reinforced by repeated negative experiences, that's getting bigger and bigger and stronger as a network, mind, brain, and body. And that is therefore driving how a person is functioning. And it follows into adolescence, adulthood, and so on. And that's why we see that pattern of adverse child experiences resulting in physical and mental challenges as they get older.
Right. And we're going to talk later about the impact of trauma, and we'll bring that back up again. So thoughts take place in our mind, not in our brain. Would that be correct?
Well, a thought lands up in the brain, but it's created by the mind. So the mind is taking the thought, like our words now are electromagnetic light waves, for example, and auditory sound waves. And it's the mind that neurophysiologically captures those and puts them into the brain, and the brain responds chemically and electromagnetically. The key thing here, and genetically, the key thing is that the brain is responding. It's not generating. So the thought and the experience of this conversation, let's use this as the example. This conversation is an experience, and an experience is building a thought. There's a big thought of mental health children, however people have labeled this conversation in their mind. And that our words are this energetic force that are becoming a physical structure inside the brain that looks like a tree. As soon as it builds in the mind and the brain, it also builds into the body, this conversation. So every experience becomes a thought in the mind and is built into the brain and the body, and it forms this network.
And we certainly know the body is intimately connected in all of this as well. You know, not only the book, The Body Keeps the Score, but also we know that so many of our physical ailments are connected to things that have happened to us, not actually physical things, but emotional things.
Well, absolutely. So every experience that you have has got all those components. It's got the emotional, the physical, the behavioral, the perspective, all those. Every experience has got all of those attached, and that gets built into the brain as a network of protein structures, and also every cell of our body. Like this conversation now is being built into the brain in a tree-like structure. At the same time, it's been built into the mind as an energetic wave. And at the same time, it's been built into the cells of the body. And we have 37 to 100 trillion cells making up every organ and system of our body. And in the cells, it looks like a little beaded, rolled up carpet. So when we have a negative experience, it's going to be a very erratic wave in the mind. It's going to be an ugly looking tree in the brain, all inflamed and ugly. Think of an ugly looking tree. And in the body, it's going to be a carpet that's unraveling. And that's a very simple analogy to understand the impact. So let's say that there's a genetic weakness, which we all have coming through the bloodline in maybe your heart. And so you go through a lot of tragic experiences or trauma or whatever, and you don't manage them. You suppress them and you don't process them and deal with them. That in the brain is this tree. In the body is these unraveled carpets. And wherever there's the weakest part of your body, that's where we're going to find the most unraveled carpets. So potentially in this case, that example I gave, there would be more unraveled carpets in the heart cells, which then increases the vulnerability of the heart to cardiovascular disease, which over time, it's not automatic, it's cumulative over time. The weaknesses there will just manifest until processed. The good news, which I just have to throw in very quickly, is that once we start processing our trauma, those carpets can wind up again. So we can re-strengthen the cells of the heart, for example, and fix those ugly looking thought trees in the brain and the waves of the mind.
Hey guys, did you know that Creating a Family has a free monthly e-newsletter? You can sign up for it by going to bit.ly/CAF guide. That's bit.ly/CAF guide. And when you do, you will receive a free guide. Right now, the guide is Parenting a Child Exposed to Trauma. The guide is our way of saying thank you for subscribing. Our newsletter is terrific. We curate some of the best resources out there to help you in your parenting journey. So go to bit.ly/CAF guide and sign up. So what is the neurocycle?
So the neurocycle is a system and a framework that I developed over 38 years ago based on theory and clinical research and clinical application, very strong foundation to help a person to influence how they build information into the mind-brain-body network. And also once it's in, for example, from a trauma or an abuse or whatever kind of trauma one experienced or even positive, once it's in the network and it's impacting how you're functioning, like an adverse child experiences in the network and it's impacting how you're functioning as an adolescent or adult, the neurocycle helps you to identify the signs of that and then track back to the thought, which is the experience, and deconstruct it in the brain and the body and the mind, and then reconstruct it. And so therefore change how it plays out into your future. So it takes advantage of how information gets from the mind into the brain and into the body, and also how that shows up and how you can then reverse engineer that process. So it's very powerful, based on very heavy science, but very simplified, and works to empower the person to be able to manage their mind. So I'm not anti, I mean, totally pro-therapy and all those kinds of things, but you've got to know how to live with yourself. We've got to teach our children from as young as possible and ourselves to be empowered to manage our mind. And the neurocycle pretty much provides that basic skill of how we manage our mind and direct the neuroplasticity of the brain.
Okay. So as we said at the beginning, we want to be talking about resilience and in how to help your child clean up their mental mess. You talk about a 5-step process to build resilience in our kids. So I would like to spend some time understanding those 5 steps, because I think that's where a lot of parents are wanting to focus. Let's start focusing on repairing the damage. Let's start focusing on helping our kids bounce back, if possible.
Absolutely. So the neurocycle is made up of 5 basic steps. So to get information from the outside in to this network, there are 5 major processes, major psychoneurobiological processes. And within each of those 5, there's a million different steps that are happening. So what I've done is over the years, I've researched that and simplified that process into something that is doable.
Good. We need doable stuff.
It's undergirded by very hectic science, but very simple in its application. Essentially, I mean, I worked with, just to give you a little bit of background, I worked a lot with people who've had obviously experienced extreme trauma, but also neurological issues like Parkinson's and dementia. In addition, other things like learning disabilities and autism and that sort of thing. So across the board, spectrumatic brain injury, those kinds of things. This was developed based on a need for a therapeutic intervention to help, for example, someone with traumatic brain injury learn how to recover, and someone with extreme sexual trauma or something like that, learn how to basically recover. Because everything that you go through never goes away. Once you experience something, it's in that network forever. But what we can do is change what that network looks like. So the neurocycle, the 5 steps of the neurocycle are basically doing that, empowering a person to change what networks look like inside of their brain. And in addition, the neurocycle enables you to also grow your brain. Our brains are very, very hungry for knowledge. So the mind-brain-body connection is looking to grow constantly and learn. So just as a quick side note, the other huge part of the neurocycle is building the brain, because things like our current social media and technology and everything, all very fantastic, but if they're not managed, they don't grow the brain properly. And that in itself can create mental health problems. And that, you know, that's worth, you know, chatting about maybe in a little bit more depth later on. So the neurocycle, therefore, is a very non-conscious process, which is non-conscious is our biggest part of how we function as humans. And it's non, as in we're not conscious of it. It's driving us 24/7. It's our most intelligent part of us. And then our conscious, which works with the non-conscious, is what we're aware of now. So we're aware of our conscious, but behind the scenes, conscious is the tip of the iceberg. We've got this massive non-conscious. The neurocycle is how the non-conscious is working. So what we are doing is we're bringing what's non-conscious into the conscious mind. Okay, so your 5 basic steps are gather awareness, reflect, write or visualize or draw, recheck, and active reach. The easiest way to understand the neurocycle is to think of flying a plane. I know this may sound very strange, but to have an analogy to hook onto is really important. When a plane is about to take off, first before it takes off, there's a lot of preparation. It's fueled and there's check things that are checked and there's flight plans. So there's a lot of preparation. One of the things we need to do as humans is prepare our brain and body and mind. So when we go through an experience like bullying or any kind of, from a minor thing like a little minor fight with a sibling to a major thing like a bullying incident or abuse, or we've just got bad habits that we've developed. So on a scale of 1 to 10, the day-to-day stuff would be 1, 2, and 3. Your bad habits that we all have would be around 4 through 7. And then the traumas, which are things that happen to us, are the 8s, 9s, and 10s. So those are the bullings and the abuses and that kind of thing. We all have a range of the bodies in our life that we're dealing with all the time. And so what the neurocycle helps us to do is to manage all three levels, the day-to-day stuff, the bad habits, plus the traumas. What we're doing is that every experience is built into us, as I've said, and what we have to do is learn to recognize how strong these networks are, and we recognize their strength by seeing how they show up. When we start becoming aware of how they show up, that can make us feel very anxious. It can make a child feel, an adult, whatever age you are, feel like, you know, this is kind of scary. And that can then create neurochemical chaos in the brain and the body. And you can, you know, have your heart beating fast and like shockwaves through your body. Or like some children used to say to me, I feel jiggly in my tummy. It's very important that one calms down the neurophysiology first before you try and do the actual work of the neurocycle. Because the neurocycle is finding the problem thought, going to the root and reconstructing. So to come back to the plane analogy, when to calm down the brain and the body, to calm down the jiggly stomach or the heart that's palpitating or whatever, the blood red cheeks or something like that, we have to prepare the mind-brain-body connection. So that's the equivalent of preparing the plane. And examples of that would be good old-fashioned breathing, all the different types of breathing, meditation, various different techniques like that that help to calm down the neurophysiology. You can do them for a minute, 3 minutes. They don't have to be long, but that's really important to prepare. Otherwise, you're fighting against, like, you know, a log in the road. It's difficult to drive through the log. You want to move the log out of the road. It's that idea. Now, if you just do that, if you just do breathing, which calms down people, it's great. Or meditation, it'll calm you down to a point where you can actually function. But if you stop there, if you just prepare a plane and you do nothing else, the plane doesn't go anywhere. You don't go anywhere. If you just do preparation, it's a band-aid on the wound. You're not actually solving the problem. You're not fixing what's the source of the anxiety or depression or the behavioral issue, whatever it is. So you then have to go into flying the plane. And flying the plane means you've got to take off, fly, and land. A pilot has to know how to do all of those. If you take off and don't know how to land, you're going to crash.
That would be a problem.
Yes. If you take off and fly and you don't know, you'll crash. You've got to be able to do all three. So the neurocycle takes you through all five steps of that process. Most traditional therapeutic techniques or interventions like CBT and psychodynamic theory and those kinds of things tend to focus on one or the other. They don't focus on the unit of five. So what I have found from my research, and I publish in scientific papers and I do clinical trials and I currently still do that, is that if you don't take your mind-brain-body connection through all five steps, you won't have sustainable change. And in addition to that, you can't just do the neurocycle once and think you're going to fix something. It has to be done daily over at least 63 days. So what I've done in my research is try to work out how long does it take to fix it, to rewire a network. In other words, rewire a habit, rewire a pattern, a driving force that we've set up. And it doesn't happen with one or two neurocycles. It's going to take at least 5 to 15 minutes a day of doing a neurocycle, which are these five steps, for at least 63 days.
And I could only guess with our kids who have had many of them, not all, but many of them have had multiple traumas, that we're not talking 63 days. We're talking consistently.
Multiple cycles. Yeah.
Yeah. We're talking consistent parent shifting our approach when we're working with them for long periods of time, I would guess.
Absolutely. So it's in units of 63 to have your change as you with trauma. So if you think of that scale of 1 to 10, something that's in the 1, 2, 3, which is maybe a little fight with a sibling, that would take one neurocycle. A habit, it's a pattern, it would take probably 2 or 3 neurocycles. A trauma could take you 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So I've had some patients who had extreme sexual trauma, and we've worked for almost 2 years over multiple neurocycles. So it's just that unit of time, it's around about 59 to 63 days, is the time it takes to change all the proteins and the trees and those carpets, the things that I spoke about earlier on, and the waves, that network. And if you don't change that network, you won't have sustainable change. You'll have change, and then you recognize, oh, I can see the hope and I can see where I'm healing, but the change is not sustainable. So you slip back, and that makes people feel stuck in tremendous frustration. So that's kind of the background. So what is the 5 steps? Gather awareness, reflect, write, recheck, active reach. So the preparation is that breathing stuff. The gather awareness is taking off, the plane taking off. Now, notice I had to use the word gather awareness. When you meditate or breathe or do mindfulness sort of exercises, which are preparation, you'll become generally aware of your thoughts and your emotions and your body. That's great. But if you just stay aware and you do nothing else, you'll get worse. That's why I said you can't just prepare. So then you need to go into gathered awareness. So step one is a very focused, specific, let's narrow down the awareness to 4 elements of how you are showing up or your child is showing up. And that is, what are your emotions? Things like I'm anxious, depressed, whatever. Where do you feel this in your body? My stomach is jiggly or whatever. What is this doing in terms of behavior, withdrawing, not sleeping, whatever? How is this altering perspective? And but that is how you're viewing life. Life sucks, hate school, don't want to go and play with friends, whatever. So there's four categories of signals that we gather awareness of and literally making like four little sentences. So you're narrowing down, I feel anxious, into let's get more specific. And when you do that, you're bringing all of that stuff, all those networks and carpet things and whatever into the conscious mind on a neuroscience level. We bring that tree-like structure into the conscious mind and we weaken the branches, which prepares it for change. And that's what you want to do. We want to change what it looks like. The way we explain it to children, and you'll see in the book, I have a lot of cartoons. I created a character called Brainy. And Brainy walks the mental health journey with you, and his superpower is the neurocycle. So there's a lot of analogies in the book for explaining these complex concepts.
Right, because I do want to bring it down to how do parents work with children in this first step, which is gathering awareness. Let's use an example. Let's say we do know the trauma. Often we don't know child. We don't know. But let's say that we know that the child experienced neglect, parents were struggling with substance abuse disorder, so that they saw parents being very incapable of parenting. Perhaps they saw domestic violence. So this is what we think that the child, but what we're seeing is a child whose behavior is difficult, and we're suspecting that it's coming from the trauma. So how would we help our child gather awareness?
You would work with them, obviously, with using prompt questions. So in the book, I've got tables with prompt questions. So if you're dealing with a 3 to 5 year old, the type of questions you'd ask, a 6 to 8 year old, and then obviously an 8 to 10 year old. So obviously different categories. And there's a whole table of these four warning signals, and it's neatly laid out. So for example, if you're dealing with, let's say, a 3 year old, and it's the first time you're sitting down with them, the easiest way to teach a child how to start processing, because that's essentially what we're doing, is for you to demonstrate yourself. So as an adult, and that's, I get asked this question often, what would you do for the mental health crisis? The first thing I would do would be to help the adults. And children will do what the adults do. So the easiest way to teach this to kids is to, first of all, learn it yourself, number one. And we'll come to all the 5 steps. I know we just didn't gather awareness. We'll work through the example. But first thing is you learn it as an adult. And you use it because it's good for you anyway. And you're going to find your own stuff because all of us have got stuff. So there is a book for adolescents and adults. And I also have an app. I don't know if you're aware of it, Dawn. I have an app called the NeuroCycle app. App. It's in the iTunes, Google Play. There's a web version, and there's like me giving therapy. I'll walk you through the process. There's also a section there for parents to help children. Okay, so the first thing is allocate an area in your house that is your mind area or your neurocycle area or your brainy area, whatever works best for the age group of the child. Don't underestimate children. They love big words. My youngest patients were 2, 3 years of age. I worked in schools. I worked in family therapy. We would teach kids as young as 2 and 3 the brain and the neurocycle words, big words. They love those words. They may not even say it that well, but they love it. And they know it's something that's going to help me feel better. So find an area in your house that is allocated, like a little bench, or like, for example, some of my patients have taken an area in, like they had a little area in the kitchen and maybe painted a wall with chalk, that chalk paint. And I'll tell you why in a moment. Put a little nice beanbag down and put a little toy box there with Brainy and whatever. So you create an area in your home that is when I'm feeling bad, I go sit there. And that's my message to whoever's my caregiver that I need some help to process. I'm not feeling great and I'm sitting here because I'm going to process myself or I'm going to. So that's very important to allocate that area. And then you start with you as an adult. You learn the system and you demonstrate. So you come home from work maybe, or you come out of a meeting and you're feeling kind of worked up and you maybe snap at your child or children, whatever. And catch yourself and say, okay, and you go sit on the little beanbag or the chair and you demonstrate and say, oh my gosh, I feel so mad emotion. So it's a little sentence, I feel mad or I feel angry. My tummy's so sore. I've got a headache. This day sucks perspective. You could even pick up a little pair of sunglasses. You can have a little box where you can have 3 pairs of sunglasses. One's all cracked, one's beautiful, and one's just a little bit scratched. And you can maybe pick up the scratched one and put that on and say, things I can't see so clearly now. If it was really bad, you'd pick up the cracked one or whatever. So there's lots of those kinds of tips in the book of having those sort of practical things. So you could pick up your sunglasses to put on your perspective, whichever pair shows the appropriate perspective at that moment. And then also behaviors, I yelled at you. So you're acknowledging, you're focusing, you gathered awareness, the plane's taken off. That's changed neurophysiology incredibly. And now you're ready to go deeper. Then very quickly you move on and you go to the reflect step. The reflect is why. The who, the what, the when, the where, the why. It's going deeper. this is the step that is very, very important, and it's hard. It's easy to gather awareness, quite easy. Does amazing stuff. I always get this feedback for years now. When people start this, it changes the focus completely, but don't stop there. Otherwise, you're just going to take off and crash. You may also find as you're gathering awareness, I would recommend maybe a little bit of deep breathing first to prepare yourself. So I would sit down on the beanbag, do some deep breathing. There's all kinds. I love breathe in for 3, out for 7, or breathe in for 6, hold for 6, out for 6. There's so many different ways, but those two kids learn very fast and they work very quickly, and they've had a lot of science behind them. So that's in for 3, out for 7. And you do it 3 or 4 times, called the 10-second pause, or in for 6, hold for 6, out for 6. Just do a few of those and then do your 4 little sentences. And you're demonstrating. You know, they're watching you. As they get more familiar, they'll start joining you. You'll see they'll naturally come and collaborate. Then you say, oh, wow, this is why I'm feeling like this. I had such a horrible call a few moments ago, whatever it is. Obviously, age appropriate. If it's a 3-year-old, mommy had a really bad call. If it's a 5-year-old, that was a horrible business. Those people were so mean. They made me very upset. They said ugly things. An 8 or 9, 10-year-old, I had a really bad business call. Those people were just awful, and they made me feel very bad about myself. So it's a little, you know, age appropriate. And I've got all these kinds of examples in the book. So you're giving them the why behind why you feel those. So it's taken it even deeper. It's loosened the branches, done more neuroscience. Then you go to step 3. And I'm doing this very quickly. Obviously, there's more depth than everything in the book and in the app. Remember I mentioned about maybe having a chalk wall. If you can't do that, just have a in the little toy box next to this beanbag or whatever the scenario is that you create. Just have a notepad. Nice big one. Have some coloring pencils or some Sharpies or something like that, and just take it out and just draw your face and a few words of, you know, maybe a smiley face that's a sad face, I should say. And if the child's not literate yet, still put the word next to it, because you're teaching that word picture association. So it's a chance to develop vocabulary, reading. It's collaborative, does a lot of amazing stuff at that point. Just writing down at this point, I can tell you now the child's looking and very interested and they're starting to collaborate. So you're inviting them into the scenario. Then you're going to the recheck. Just quickly to come back to step 3, you're writing down what you've gathered awareness of and what you've reflected on. So you could draw a sad face, you know, a sore tummy in the most simple way. It could just be hands on a round thing. It doesn't have to be a work of art. It could be a few words. It could be a few scribbles. It's just to represent those 4 different signals. And maybe just something bad day at work, something like that, a little statement or something that just represents that. The older they are, the more words you put down. And each day, remember, you're not solving the problem in one day. You are solving it over time. I'm just giving you an on-the-spot example. Then you would recheck the 4th step. You'd look at what you've written and you'd say, wow, this is what's happened. Now, what am I going to do about this? That's your key question for that step, where you're reconceptualizing. And that's just a very broad overview. But that could be something like where you invite the child in and they may say, oh, shame, mommy, I'm sorry you had such a horrible meeting. Maybe you should send an email, or maybe you should, whatever. Kids come up with pearls of wisdom that may or may not give you insight.
But hot chocolate. You need hot chocolate, mom.
Something like that. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Let's make hot chocolate. But recheck is more for solving the problem. Then hot chocolate would be active reach. Okay, that's a fantastic idea. I'm going to send an email and tell them that I didn't like what they said, and whatever language, age appropriate, you'd give as much detail as is necessary per age. And then you'd go to an action. You've helped me so much. Let's go and make hot chocolate together, or let's walk the dog or something like that. So then you've demonstrated those 5 steps in a very, very simple way. And they see that you now are being authentic. Children love authenticity. You've respected their insight. Kids are a lot more insightful than we've given them. Mm-hmm. Grace, I put a lot of studies in the book about explaining that too. They respond to authenticity, they respond to your modeling and so on. So that's how I would teach to children. Then when they come home from school, let's say they come home or you pick them up from school and they're throwing a tantrum in the back of the car, but it's a 3-year-old, or they're withdrawing, if they're an 8-year-old, whatever, they're just different. You pick them up from school and you notice that something's off. They get home, they're still off. So you can say, do you want to do a neurocycle? Do you want to go sit in the beanbag and, you know, do the neurocycle? They may spontaneously go there. We've actually made a plush toy of Brainy. There's even a coloring book with different scenarios. You have all of the kit together. And even the actual books filled with cartoons that children can respond to. And children are great at picking up. We've tested this. I mean, I've done this for years. We've analyzed this and done studies on it, where you have this kit together. Children will pick up the book and point to the different characters and things like that. The point is you're giving them tools, a toolkit to develop the mental skills to deal with the experience. And that in itself unmasks resilience, because resilience is naturally in us, but we have to unmask it. And by suppressing, we mask resilience. And by processing, we unmask resilience.
One question I have. So in the example that you gave, you had a bad meeting. You came home and yelled at your kid and you sat down and you went through this. At one point is there a point where you would say, yeah, I was mad and I yelled at you. I took it out on you and I'm sorry.
Oh yeah. You would. Sorry. I didn't say that. You automatically would. I did this and I'm sorry. So in the reflect part, you'd come very quickly. I did this. You'd label the four signals. And as you reflect, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that. This is why I did it. So you'd preface, obviously the apology comes along with the reason I did this. You're not justifying why you did that, but you're explaining why you did that. And you're
well, yeah, exactly. And I think it's important to make reparations. If
oh, absolutely.
I broke sister's toy because whatever, I broke her toy. I was mad because dad played with my older brother outside and he wouldn't let me come outside to play. And I was mad. I broke sister's toy. And then both of you apologize. But is there a part where after we bring awareness in the way that we solve the problem is being aware that we were angry that dad didn't play with us. But, you know, how am I going to make it up to sister who I broke her toy?
Yes, well, that comes into the reflect. You need to bring in the apology immediately. So you've identified your four signals with gather awareness, and then you're going to reflect. And part of your reflection is the impact that it's had. So it's the empathy, it's the awareness, it's the taking responsibility. It is, you know, if you don't break toys, I understand that you broke the toy for a reason, but first we need to apologize to your sister. That'll come as an act of reach, but you need to recognize that that's not an acceptable way of, you know, that's unkind. It's hurtful. They're going to be upset. You wouldn't like it. So that comes in your reflect section, which is very close up front. But at the same time, you're going to say to them, that's unacceptable, but I recognize you did that for a reason. So our action, when we get to the act of reach, when we do our little plan at the end, we're going to go and see how we're going to make reparations, to use your wording there, mm-hmm. as well as let's also see what it is that you were upset about. You wanted to play with dad too. Let's work out a better way. By the time you've written that all down, you get to the recheck. What's a better way that we could have handled this? What is a good way that we could say sorry? So you do all the planning. And then the first step is then let's go do those actions.
That's the act of reach.
The act of reach is the first step. The second step is the reflection on the why and the impact and the apologies and so on. Mm-hmm. The writing gathers more information, brings it to mm-hmm. the fore from the unconscious, because there may be other situations and other scenarios and things that will come up. Not maybe, it will. Things will come up that are related that you don't even see that are related. And then your recheck is where you do a lot of the work, where there's a lot of, you know, we don't operate like this, I recognize this, whatever, all that. And that then says, okay, how can we wrap this up now and land the plane? And what are the action steps? What are we going to do? Mm-hmm. We're going to go to your sister and say, I'm so sorry, and here's one of my toys, or whatever they decide. We're going to have sit with dad and talk with dad and say, next time, can you explain why he played with whatever? Whatever mm-hmm. those actions mm-hmm. are that you'll work out in the recheck. So you're collaborating and facilitating and empowering the child to solve problems as opposed to solving problems for them, mm-hmm. which leads to, you know, the whole concept of safety net parenting versus helicopter parenting. And I've got a whole section of that in the book too, where your helicopter parenting is where you're not allowing a child to solve problems, where there's more discipline and no learning that's taking place. You're not allowing them to make the mistakes, to fall, mm-hmm. to fail, that kind of thing. That's really important. The helicopter parent is doing everything, whereas the safety net parenting, if you think of an acrobat, there's a safety net, they climb up the ladder different heights and they jump and swing and do whatever, and then they go higher. And sometimes they fall. We can't go up there with the child and put the safety net directly under and swing with them. We've got to let them climb up and fall, and you the mm-hmm. safety net, you know, and that sort of thing, which is hard.
It is hard.
Jennifer Garner was interviewed the other day, and the comment, the highlight of the heading was something along the lines of, it's good to let your children fail, or something like that. It wasn't those words. It was even more catchy. And she basically talked about that, about how she allows her kids to make mistakes, and we don't do enough of that. So it's that sort of concept.
I think that is at the heart of resiliency as well, is to know that you can fall, you make mistakes, but you can repair the mistakes.
Absolutely.
And that you have it within you. You don't have to turn to an adult to do that.
No, you've got it within you. And that's the problem solving skills. You know, it's interesting that a few years ago, and it's not that long ago, kids would have up to 4 hours a day of unstructured play. It's in that region. Now it's down to just a few minutes a day of unstructured play.
Yeah.
And that's changed their problem-solving skills, you know, where they've become so focused on the external locus of control, they're not developing an internal locus mm-hmm. of control. So this neurocycle is all about empowering to develop an internal locus of control in a co-regulated way. The younger they mm-hmm. are, becoming more and more self-regulated. That's the principle operating.
And this is also a way of you use the word co-regulating with your child.
Absolutely.
Which is another amazing tool to build resiliency, because self-regulation is crucial.
It's key.
Yeah, it is key.
In my research, that's really key, that we've shown that over that 63-day cycle, when you go through a full cycle, if you stop it too soon, the self-regulation doesn't develop enough to be a point where it's sustainable. So they don't get empowerment. So if you just half do things, if you skip some of those steps, the five steps, or if you just do it to a certain time point, the child still becomes dependent on external locus of control. And an adult, they'll become over-therapeutized. You know, we talk about an over-therapeutized nation and that kind of thing, become over-dependent on others. There's nothing wrong with having collaborative, we need collaborative, deep, meaningful relationships. You all know that. But we shouldn't be relying on someone else to make our decisions. And that's where that whole time frame is so important. Self-regulation is vital.
Let me take a moment to tell you about a new podcast from Creating a Family. We are calling it Weekend Wisdom, and it's different from this podcast. This podcast is, as you know, an hour-long interview with an expert. In Weekend Wisdom, we're answering your questions in a very short form, 5-10 minutes, no more. So check it out. It drops on the weekend. And don't forget, you can submit your own questions. I can't tell you how much I have enjoyed getting questions from our audience. It's really been enlightening for me to see what questions are coming in. So make sure you send in your questions to info@creatingafamily.org. Put Weekend Wisdom, if you remember, in the Ray line, but either way, it will work its way to me and we'll add it to our list of questions to answer on Weekend Wisdom. The examples that you gave and then I gave, you gave a scale of 10. Those would be 1, 2, and 3, a bad meeting or a child breaking a toy and having a squabble with a sibling. So let's move it up, because a lot of our kids have much bigger issues that they have faced that are influencing unconsciously. They are not aware that having witnessed domestic violence makes them more likely to have tantrums or whatever. They're unaware of this. So how would we use your approach to build resiliency in kids who've had a series of traumatic events in their life before they arrived with you?
Absolutely. So there's a whole chapter, by the way, on trauma in the book as well. So essentially, this is going to take time. So coming back to that scale, this would be an 8, 9, and 10. So trauma is something that's happened to us, whereas the 1 through 7 are things that, you know, we do, the things that just happen and things that we do.
Right,
like.
Right, exactly.
So this is things that have happened to us. So the big thing is going to be observation initially, where you notice patterns in your children, or the teacher notices patterns, or the caregiver, the grandparent, whoever is very involved in the child's life, is to identify the patterns. And these patterns are very often the labels that are currently given to children, like that's ADD and ADHD and bipolar depression and terrible to label. There's a whole chapter on labels as well. That concept of diagnosing a child based on how they're showing up mentally in terms of behaviors and emotions and so on is not actually scientific at all. It's been disproved, but it's very much the model that's used. And when you label a child who's been through trauma and is showing up with quite strong behavioral patterns, like they could be, you know, hitting others or just very difficult in the classroom or having really bad nightmares, or, you know, even sexually abused children show a lot of sort of sexual behaviors that are inappropriate and they often battle at school. And there's actually a story in the book of a child who was very, very sexually abused from 3 months of age. Terrible, terrible story. It ends up happy, but it's a sad story. And those behaviors for years, what the parents observed were one negative pattern after another, which was all from the sleep to the sexual behaviors to the not focusing at school to being difficult to lots of tantrums to not being able to sleep through the night. And, you know, that creates a desperate situation for parents as well, obviously. And going to doctors and getting labels, which has kind of made things worse, and medication. So what they did with that particular child was 8 when they heard about my stuff. So just to give you this as an example, and some of my patients, whatever, and what a parent can do, the important thing is to observe the patterns and to see, like, for example, what is the consistent pattern in terms of the 4 signals and how long is it happening? So, for example, if you take sleep, what is the sleep pattern? Repeated nightmares every night or 3 times a night or 1-3 times a week? What happens with the nightmares? What are the types of nightmares? How often are the nightmares? So you could have, like, literally do a neurocycle for you as a parent to observe the patterns and to kind of be almost the observer of your child for a period of time. And mm-hmm. then there could be the emotion, you know, looking if there's a specific pattern of behavior, like they just can't seem to form relationships with friends. They can't make lasting friendships. There always seems to be some kind of drama, or there's always a problem at school. You're always getting called in. Get those big categories. Let's say it's nightmares. Let's say always getting called in at school because the child pulled someone's hair or done something to hurt another child. Maybe it's also schoolwork is not great. So let's say that those maybe are the three patterns. Now that you've heard this, what I would do as a parent is then observe those patterns over a period of about 3 weeks and get as much information as possible using the five steps as your guidelines. So you could just sit down yourself and do an initial overview of that particular thing, the nightmares, what is the general pattern? So gather awareness, reflect a little bit, write it down, recheck a bit and get some active reaches. So it could be a thing like, okay, they are waking up three times a night. That's the behavior. They are screaming when they wake up. It's always screaming and the face is very contorted and they're grabbing their stomach and they are terrified to go back to sleep. You know, the who, what, when, where, why it's happening. It seems to be triggered more often when this and the situation or something happens, or it seems to be better at this time. So a bit of a reflection, write that down. As you're writing that down, just like literally a mind dump, not a journal, just put down whatever thoughts come up. That will dig deeper into the non-conscious, not the unconscious. Unconscious is when we're asleep. The non-conscious is where our stuff is stored. And you want to connect the conscious to the non-conscious. So the first two steps and the third step start digging down. As you write, you're pulling stuff up.
This is the parent doing this now. We haven't involved the child.
This is the parent. Okay. You start with the parent first. So we start with the parent first as an observation. I'm giving an example of the parent, what they would do. So a general sit down and do a general first couple of neurocycles to get the pattern, write it down, do a bit of a recheck. Okay, I'm seeing this. I think it could be that. I'm seeing this is the pattern. My action is, okay, I'm going to now specifically look for this. Because doing that neurocycle on your own, maybe or with your partner, whatever, you're going to get more insight. It's more organized. It's not just this nightmare behavior, big chaotic thing. It becomes more specific. Then that will guide you to look more deeply into the nightmare behavior and start observing more and creating another neurocycle with more details. And then when you feel confident enough that you've got a pattern, then you could sit down with the child in, you know, the beanbag area, the neurocycle area, the brain area, whatever you call it, and start saying, you know what, I've noticed that you have nightmares. And then you start walking through and guiding them through the five steps in a very simple way over 63 days. So day one, you don't ever push them beyond what they can cope with. If they don't want to talk about it the first day, you simply run through as simple as possible. Is it okay if I tell you what I've seen? And then you talk through in those five steps, literally, I've seen you do this, I've seen you do that. You know, make it like a script almost for yourself. And then as you're talking, invite them to collaborate. Am I right? Do you think I'm right? Does this? So you start walking them through that process. And then the next day, you can take it a little bit further. And don't force them. If there's a day in between, don't go longer than 5 minutes. You know, if you don't have to do it for hours, honestly, this, and if you only manage to get the first step done and the child pulls away, don't force it either. You don't want this to become a negative thing. So ideally, you want to do all five steps every day, but that's nothing's ever ideal. So I've got a whole chapter on timing of keeping you, you know, just do what you can. If it takes you a whole week to get through 1 year cycle, that's fine. It doesn't matter. You've started the process. Eventually, the child will get into the flow, but you slowly build up over time and you'll start seeing within a few days, even, you know, it may take a couple of weeks, you'll start seeing a lot of clarity on the pattern and you may start getting solutions. Like, for example, in the book, the little child's example that we gave, this child observed the mom doing it because the mom was battling so much with this child's behavior that she did the neurocycle just to get herself to cope and her behavior changed. And this child observed her and said, I want to do what you're doing. It's making you happy, mommy. And that's how he literally got into doing an 8-year-old doing the neurocycle with his mom. Within 4 days, he was sleeping. He'd never slept through the night. He was 8 years at this age. He very quickly got in with the nightmares, was one of the first things they started with. He drew a picture, one of his active reaches, and it's in the book, a picture of a house with two chimneys. And the one chimney was scary stuff coming out, and the other one was hearts coming out. And he literally trained himself without even knowing he was doing it, lucid dreaming, where he realized that that nightmare was all those ugly things. And each of those little ugly things was something that he remembered. And he would talk that through with his mom when he did his neurocycle. But tonight he's going to have his little heart coming up. And the heart is, if I dream that and I wake up, I'm going to dream this. And he had pictures drawn and he had them in front of, stuck them up on the wall. Can you see what I'm saying? That the child, he drove that process. He worked out a way. Not all kids will work out ways, but my experience working as a family therapist and individual therapist and all the things that I do and just feedback from people around the world over the years is that kids, once they see you do it, once they get into this, you can get boxes, you can get shoe boxes. cut out pictures of emotions, all different age groups, all different behaviors, the four different signals, get toys, whatever, create a toy box and have that available for a child. A child's really good at going and picking up things and saying, this is what I feel and that's what I feel. They don't have the words because they don't. The expression is not as high as their reception. They understand better than they can express all the way through. It takes years for us to develop those skills of expressing how we feel. And even then as adults, it's hard. So it's to have those tools. So there's lots of those kinds of techniques that you can build in. Also, just to add to that, if you see that this pattern is occurring and you start seeing big stuff and the child actually reveals, yes, uncle, whatever, touched me in the, you know, did this to me, and you manage to get that out, you as a parent need to make sure that you do a neurocycle to get yourself calm, because your reaction is going to be the stress of the parent will be the stress of the child. And so therefore, it's really important that you practice keeping a empathic, calm face. As much as you want to go and kill that uncle and start crying and freak out, which is very valid, go do that. But in that moment, you've got to stay as calm as possible and then go do your freak out or do therapy or whatever. And the neurocycle can help you, whatever. But you now have written down, because you're journaling all of this, it's keeping a record of all of this. You've now got information that you can go through to a therapist with and say, look, this is what we found. Now we need guidance. We need support. We need some serious play therapy here. And I need to know how to handle this because this is like overwhelming me. But to go and to give a therapist that kind of level of knowledge, advancement with a child then in therapy will be so much more focused and so on.
Yes, and you're not suggesting that for really big issues that we not seek therapy.
Not at all.
Yes, exactly.
And I mentioned that in the beginning, that therapy shouldn't be an endless thing that you go on forever and ever that goes around in circles. Therapy should be there to give us the guidance and facilitation in a clear way that we need when we need it. And so therefore, the more empowered you are to understand what you're going through, the more you can then empower the therapist, who can then be so equipped to guide you. So it's a really great facilitative relationship.
I hope you're enjoying this conversation as much as I am. If you appreciate this conversation with Dr. Caroline Leaf, you'll be happy to hear about some free courses we are offering at bit.ly/JBF support. That's bit.ly/JBF support. Our partners, the Jockey Bean Family Foundation, have sponsored a library of courses that will support you on learning more about parenting and being the best parent possible to your child. So check it out today and tell a friend. So the last thing I want to touch on is that you had raised it a little earlier. You said you wanted to talk about social media. How does social media impact our kids' resilience? Which is one of the reasons we encourage not giving kids phones and social media and unsupervised access to the internet too soon. But nonetheless, how have you seen social media impact kids' resilience?
Okay, so this, it's a huge question. But first of all, social media is fantastic. It's not the social media, it's the management. So we don't have a mental health crisis. We have a mind management crisis, of which the mental health epidemic or pandemic is a symptom of that. And so mind management's our crisis. So what we need to be teaching our children in a changing world is how to manage a changing world. So what there isn't enough of is, hey, listen, it's great to go and see your friends on Instagram, but you need to know that if you're feeling, when you scroll through and you see all those girls that are starving themselves, because I mean, we're seeing these children getting anorexia and food disorders from as young as 5 and 6 and 7 in this current day and age, it's for you to sit down as a parent and help that child to recognize the symptoms, those four signals of, when I look at that, it's making me feel like this. It's making me do those things. So it's really sitting with a child and showing them yourself. When I look at this post and you walk through a neurocycle of how that makes them feel, can we try one with what this makes you feel? It's teaching your child how to understand the impact of social media, using yourself as example, and then helping them to process that. So it's really an essence of mind management. The other issue, I mean, there's so many issues, I could talk for hours about this, but I've only got time to deal with two things. The other thing, which is really important, is how it's affected our reading and our deep thinking. Our mind-brain-body connection is designed for deep intellectual thought from very young. And we're not designed to scroll and see so much data without processing it. We're designed to see data, or structured to see data and think about it and, you know, select, think deeply, get some level of understanding, and then look at the next bit of data. So we designed, there's all this data, let me select that, let me go deep on that. What's happening when children just scroll, adults just scroll, this is adults too, and just watch TV and jump from one thing to another, it creates no time for that deep processing to happen and for all the networks to stabilize. So you have very unstable networks and it's constant firing of activity, which social media that's unmanaged will give you. And that then creates tremendous feelings of anxiety and depression and all those scary big words that are not diseases, but are emotional warning signals that something's going on. And a quick way to start fixing that is don't say stop the social media, because whatever you tell them to stop doing, they're going to do or try and do, it just makes it more attractive. Say you can do it, but for every hour of TV, there's an hour of deep reading. For every half an hour on social media, there's deep reading. The more you read, at the top of my prescription list for all my patients when I practice was read, read, read. It's the first thing. When you read, I've done podcasts on this as well. Reading opens up the networks of the psychoneurobiological network, the mind-brain-body connection, to a point where you increase the resilience and you create a natural hunger. You activate the natural hunger to think more deeply. So once a child experiences that, they're not going to be satisfied with the surface level social media. So once you bring in the deep reading and the fantasy reading, which can be done in so many different ways, together as a group at night when they go to bed, you could be reading chapter books over time and all kinds of things. So many ways you can help to counteract that. So that's just one quick way of doing that.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Caroline Leaf, for talking with us today on building resilience in our kids. I truly appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Vista Del Mar, for your long-term support of both this podcast, but even more important, perhaps, is your support for our mission at Creating a Family. We really appreciate your support. Vista Del Mar is a licensed nonprofit adoption agency with over 65 years of experience helping to create families. They offer a home study only service as well as full service infant adoption, international home study, and post-adoption support. They also have a foster to adopt program. You can find them online at vistadelmar.org/adoption.